Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about how to get away with murder in D&D. You know, if your party is trying to take out an evil leader, or you're a DM writing a murder mystery, what steps should the thief character take to avoid being foiled by magic powers like ESP or Speak with Dead or Resurrection? It's not as easy as you think. We're going to talk about that and a whole lot more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into how to get away with murder, a lighter reminder, folks, that at the end of the show, as always, will be available for our hosting our after party chat, which is a live video chat that Dan and I host for an hour after the show with all of our patrons. And you can join in by becoming a patron. Visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, join at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our private Discord server. Get that all set up during the course of the show, and about 10 after 2 Eastern time, we should be there ready to chat with you all.
We love hanging out with folks in the after chat because, again, we have just some of the smartest, brightest patrons and viewers here at Wandering DMs. This show in particular is a little bit of a continuation from last week when we were talking about mysteries in D&D and the issues of a DM managing a murder mystery plot, possibly. And some of the really great ideas we had in the after chat last week was, well, you know, if D&D has known magic powers for detection, locating things, the thief or the criminal or the assassin should know about that and take that into account when they're preparing their plot. And that's what we're talking about here today, Paul. So hopefully we'll get some more ideas in the after chat after this that we didn't think about. But my feeling today is that I kind of want to workshop with you, Paul, and with our viewers. Like, if we want to write, if we want to write a reasonable murder story in D&D, hopefully we can do better than, like Len Lakofka in Assassin's Knot, where he just kind of hand-waved the magic doesn't work, and he didn't explain it. So I'm hoping that maybe we can workshop and come up with some better ideas here today.
Oh, I'm sure we can. I'm eager to see what folks in the chat come up with.
Also, thanks to our patrons for checking in that we are connected, because we've been a little dicey the last 2 weeks, and also reminding us about some stuff we're gonna say later today.
Yeah.
Good awesome. Calls. So, from the thief's perspective, like the criminal's perspective, right? How to get away with a crime when you're facing kind of the standard D&D abilities. And Paul, my thinking was, you know, so as soon as we announced this, we had some really great comments on our Discord server, actually. And there was one. So our really great viewer, Vino Azulman, made one of these classic memes, and I belly laughed for about 5 minutes when I saw this. So last week we were talking about solving crimes, about managing players solving murder mysteries in D&D, and this week we're going to be talking about committing crimes. And as many of us know, some of our characters are referred to as murder hobos. So we're going to kind of lean in on the murdering part of the story. At least some of our friends on Discord were particularly excited about talking about the committing the crime perspective, which will be part of the story this week.
It's fascinating. I can't remember if we've talked about this or not, but it's kind of adjacent to the heist type of adventure. Just with an interesting twist of you're not trying to just steal stuff, you're trying to maybe actually eliminate someone. So that's cool.
When I was writing my notes this morning, Paul, there were a number of times where I was like trying, like I actually accidentally wrote heist when I was trying to write something else, actually. So I totally feel exactly that. So maybe this is how to get away with a heist, including stealing somebody's life in the game, okay. Possibly.
Okay. Well, I was focused on the murder part, which is very interesting. But we can certainly broaden it to just like heists or getting away with crimes in general. That's interesting. Okay. So I had two big questions that came to mind, Dan, when you proposed this topic. You know, the first, and I'm going to not be surprised when you have very qualified answers to all of these, but the first is, well, what edition of D&D are we talking about, Dan? Because that changes things radically.
I think you're right, and I think that's something you got to kind of talk about. So if you dig into the details of these kinds of powers, it makes a difference. You're totally right. So we're going to have to qualify that a little bit with what edition you're talking about. And of course, for me, I have a big stack of books ready. Today, when these questions come up, for me, mostly original D&D and AD&D, and maybe our viewers can help us if there's particular things that are radically different in fifth edition now. I guess I want to know about that. So for me, mostly original AD&D.
Yeah.
Some of the magic powers got shaved off, right? Specifically for the issues we're talking about today. There's things that they kind of nerfed a little bit specifically for this stuff. So at the outset, in original D&D, magic's pretty powerful.
I was assuming we'd be focusing on classic edition, so that's good. And then one of the things I did just in prep for this is I got out my favorite, hint, secretly only, cross edition D&D source book, the Marvelous Magic book, specifically written for both Dungeons and Dragons, and also quote, and just right on the cover, also compatible with Advanced Dungeons and Dragons.
Fascinating.
Absolutely fascinates me. So I took a little flip through that just to see if there's any fun magic items that might help me get away with murder. I think there's a few in there. So I'll bring those up over the course of things. But apart from the addition question, the other major question I have is, to what end? Right? Why are we trying to commit murder? And I think that's super important because the interesting thing is I found that while there is a lot of magic that makes it difficult to commit murder in like the classic sense as we think of it in, say, your average Agatha Christie mystery, it also opens the door to a lot of other ways to torment or eliminate our enemies. And I think there are many cases where maybe murder is not the right answer. And maybe the fact is you want a different solution. So what are our goals here, Dan?
this is legitimate. Well, you know, I am, and again, Vino Ozel reminded us of in the Little Brown Books, there is a table of hirelings. Maybe we just pull it up briefly. The table's got the yellow highlighting on it. So, right, Little Brown Books, the very first edition of D&D, now 51 years ago, there's a table of specialists that you can hire. The text leading into this says you get access to these specialists if you have a stronghold. So you're in a situation where presumably you've established a barony, you have a name level character, you have a castle, and now you get to hire some folks. And notably on the table at one of the more expensive ones is an assassin. You can hire an assassin. And here I'm going to the book since you asked to see exactly what it says that gets you. One second. Okay, so the assassin. The role of this hireling is self-evident.
Of course.
The referee will decide what chance there is of his mission being accomplished by noting the precautions taken by the intended victim. Assassins are not plentiful, and some limit on the number employable during the game during any game year must be enforced. So it's self-evident. My inference would be, I feel that this was a case of running a campaign in Greyhawk or Blackmoor where at name level, the players became somewhat competitive and you might be hiring an assassin to go eliminate another stronghold owner, perhaps, is the first thing that comes to my mind. It gets fleshed out a little bit more in Dave Arneson's Blackmoor supplement, where there's an actual assassin class for the first time, with different level titles. And there he specifies that what we're looking at right now by default is a sixth level assassin. So mid-level might be higher, might be lower if you change the cost a little bit. And there he gives the formal table of percentage chances of exactly what chance it is that your assassin for hire, presumably for hire, succeeds on his mission. So I think that's my top guess.
From that description, right, I assume that the targets of these assassinations are not like other players, right? That these are plot-centric NPCs, you know, important, whatever, to the machinations of the other players, perhaps. But the assassinations that can happen off-camera that are, you know, that you're not going to play round-to-round, that are just like, okay, well, maybe this guy gets killed or not, the end. Right. You know, the problem with that kind of like classic murder, of course, and that we came up with last season, or last episode rather, is simply, you know, how easy it is to just undo that, right? I mean, just raise him, right? Just cast a raise dead, and right.
Yes.
Oh well, problem solved.
Yeah. Maybe let's talk about and tell me if this is a good way to approach this. Like mm-hmm. I was saying, maybe we should talk about like low level magic powers and then kind of graduate up to the higher stuff like raise dead, because maybe we can get a grip on like the lower level powers and how you would counter that. So does that make sense, Paul?
Sure. Okay. I'm curious kind of low level powers you're looking at. Yeah, let's go with it.
Let's say you're following Dave Arneson's advice and you have you've got some kind of low level target. I don't know, gang leader, low level warlord, I don't know. And you hire a lower level assassin to go do your evil, horrible bidding work. So if you look at the magic powers, right, among the first things that comes up, like a charm person, like it's almost in original D&D, that's almost the first spell. So charm person just totally takes control of somebody. And as far as I can tell, they'll just tell you, we discussed this last time, we don't need to get it. They just tell you whatever you want. So how do you get around charm person?
It sounds to me like, Dan, that your focus here is not so much how to perform the murder, but how to get away with it, right?
Well,
how
what
to,
are you going
to
do?
Avoid the investigation post-mortis. Is that what we're going at? Like, okay.
I mean, I'm assuming. Maybe I am overlooking something. So, you know, traditionally, assassins have disguise to get into a place. They get to use poison to help eliminate their targets. They have extra languages. Actually, I wouldn't have recalled this, except I just saw it. Dave Arneson's assassin has the unique ability to learn other alignment languages. To like completely trick other people, which is kind of interesting. So I'm assuming you got something like that, get into the place.
But where are you going with the charm person, I guess? Are you assuming that the investigators have caught the assassin and that they're now going to charm him and convince him to tell them what's going on?
Okay, well, my takeaway is you can't have a big crew. Like if you have a big local crew, you have a higher vulnerability surface for investigators to get anyone in the conspiracy, hit them with charm person, and just blab out the whole plot. So I think my takeaway from that is the assassin's got to work alone. So that as long as they get away, there's no trail to interrogate after them, which makes sense because traditionally you hire assassins one at a time. They're supposed to only work alone. So I think my takeaway is as long as they're working alone, something like charm person is a dead end.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, you know, you're relying on that hefty fee of the assassin to assume that the assassin knows their craft well enough that they know how to lay low after the fact.
Agreed. Right? So that's
be unobserved. Right? Right. Yeah. And there's plenty of like be unobserved stuff, right? Because this is where I was thinking. I was thinking you're talking about like, well, how, like, what if I am the assassin, right? So now we've got powers like, say, invisibility, right? You know, sleep to get past the guards, that sort of stuff. You know, it's nice low level spells there to get in and out quickly without anyone ever knowing who did it, right? Like, that's really the.
Well, let's dig into that just for a second. This is a good point. Now, I'm thinking, you know, assassin class, which is traditionally a subclass of thief. So we can just talk a little bit about how, for their own benefit, how does the thief assassin get access to casting magic like that? I bet we can come up with a couple ideas for that.
Yeah, there's potions, there's scrolls. They could hire a wizard, right? There's plenty of ways. or just be now, be multi-class? Is that a possibility?
I'm thinking that. Now, so I think we know that traditionally thieves have the special ability to maybe use magic scrolls, right? Not every, like a fighter can't use a scroll of sleep or invisibility. But actually a thief can originally. In my games, I kind of scrub that off, but I do allow multi-classing. So I would actually allow a thief to have maybe like a couple levels of wizard, and then that unlocks the scrolls. And of course, that's all inspired by Liber's Gray Mouser, a famous thief character who had a little bit of wizard training, which allowed him to read scrolls. So yeah, you could read a scroll. Also, Ring of Spell Storing is also a good option because anybody can use that.
Sure. I mean, there's lesser things, right? You know, you get yourself an elven cloak and boots, get yourself a ring of invisibility.
That's key.
You know, lots of ways, lots of ways to be invisible. Right, you want to maybe get a nice hat of disguise.
That's good. Yeah. I mean, assassins have disguise ability already, just naturally. So you don't even need to. You don't even need the magic for that.
Yep.
But those are really key options.
Now, Dan, we're like bordering into just like how to get away with murder in like the real world, and that's not fun. Like that's not.
Well, I mean, Ring of Invisibility. We agree. Ring of Invisibility is really key.
Yeah, I remember a long time ago, like maybe when I was in college, making a character who was a thief magic user, specifically with the idea of, you know, what would it be like to be, see, a cat burglar, but like who could turn invisible and fly? Like that, surely that makes cat burglaring much easier, right?
Yes. You know, in Len Lakofka's Assassins, one of the things that is kind of clever, and this is something in first edition, is the assassin has a cloak of etherealness, and that's what sets up the sealed room murder. That's how he actually got into the place. Again, that's a magic item appeared in first edition.
None of this obviates the problem of, like, they could just get raised, right? Like, If Raise Dead is available to players, right, then surely it's available to your band of thugs who decide we're going to go pay the money to have our ringleader raised from the dead.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So that's probably among the keenest things. And, you know, on the one hand, Raise Dead has been in the game since forever. It is a top level cleric spell, but the game does seem designed to make that reasonably available, so clerics get that, you know, at ninth level. I think there's text in some things that really ought to be the priest of the town really ought to have Raised Dead, so your player can come back. So what can you do to prevent the raising? And the most obvious thing, I think David Heron said it in the chat first, is you can't leave a body.
Just don't. Yeah.
So you're going to find some way of eliminating the body. That will actually foil a Raised Dead or Resurrection spell in most iterations. So how are you going to get rid of it? I mean, you could do the movie, I don't know, bathtub full of acid, I guess. That's, there's that. You know, or
incinerate it in some way, right?
Yep. Possibly.
You know.
Possibly do that. My one thought I had, you know, somehow you can remove it. One thought I had is, how about a bag of devouring?
Interesting. Okay.
If you have a bag of devouring, initially I was like bag of holding to carry it away. And then I was like, wait a minute, even better. Nobody wants a bag of devouring. That's a cursed item that you don't want. So maybe the assassin actually does want a bag of devouring, specifically just like consume the body when you eliminate it.
Yep. I mean, that's, you know, just looking at the spell list, right? I know I'm jumping around here and going up crazy power levels, but like, there's just, you just use the disintegrate spell, right? Disintegrate.
Yes, that's key. That's key. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's actually really, and that seems, get that on a scroll seems possibly easier to access, maybe. Just disintegrate the body. That's actually a really good option.
Let me give you another twist on this, which is a spoiler alert for the Enemy Within campaign, because this is what happens in this very campaign. So this is in, I think, Power Behind the Throne, which we were discussing last week. In that case, they just shove the body in a crate, right? They just hide it. Shove it in a trunk. But what's truly clever about the plot line there is they then replace the victim with a doppelganger. So leave no evidence that a murder happened, right? The victim. There's no evidence of any murder. And, you know, again, this begs the question, to what end, right? To what end?
Yeah.
Right. If I'm trying to control a group or something, great. Now I've got a pawn in place, somebody who's, you know, replacing this. Yeah. And there's no evidence that a murder even happened.
That's great. Yeah. That's super. That's pretty top level. That's nice.
Yeah. It definitely, and it tell from the text, I believe, like, this is probably the most likely way that your characters actually discover this part of the plot is that they find the body. Right? If you're searching in the right places, you're going to find the crate and open up and be like, "Well, here's a dead body of this guy who is clearly still alive over there. What's going on?"
Nice. Very nice. Yeah. Very nice. You know, you can talk about, you know, when you start bringing in monsters on the criminal side, right, that opens up some additional things. And again, me trying to be as close to the text as possible, one thing I would look at is, in original D&D, arguably the most terrifying monster is the vampire. And in first edition, it is canonical that they can be classed. So it specifically says in the monster manual that for vampires is, thus it is possible to have a vampiric thief or cleric, etc. And the very first thing they mention actually is a vampiric thief. So maybe your assassin, maybe you're the top level assassin in your campaign is also a vampire, and that would allow them to fly to begin with, turn into a bat so it doesn't look like there's a person there, gaseous form to get into a locked room would actually be possible. And then they could either just, you know, attack them, they could level drain them, or kind of like you're thinking, they could charm them into service. And any one of those things become options for you.
Yeah. Yeah. There's lots of roads down that road of, like, you know, well, instead of killing them, maybe just, you know, ensorcel them in some way to do whatever it is you want them to do. Again, to the you know, it gets very situational here again of like, well, why are we doing this, right? So I think a little bit to have this conversation, I need to root myself in, like, no, it is beneficial, let's say, to eliminate. We want this person simply gone, to not exist anymore. But that was, you know, the like, replace him with a doppelganger is a fun one from that adventure. You know, but again, so. Now the next thing I want to do is go down the road of, like, well, don't kill them, but remove them, send them to another plane of existence, trap them in magic somehow. Here I am with my, I'm looking through my expert book in the magic items. Get yourself a nice mirror of life stealing.
Oh, yep. And of course that comes from a famous Conan story originally. So in the tradition, mirror of life trapping is a really good thing for that, actually.
Sucks them into the mirror. Their body, there's no body because they're in the mirror. It's just in the mirror. You know, they once they're in the mirror, they're completely trapped. You know, they can't get out unless somebody breaks the mirror. You know, the interesting thing about mirror of life trapping is, right, it says it will store man-sized or smaller creatures, can store up to 20 creatures. Doesn't say they have no need for food or air. They don't age. They're completely trapped. Nothing in the description tells me the size of the mirror. How big is this?
This was exactly my next question, Paul. It depends. I think that traditionally it tends to be a little bulky. If you go to the Conan story, it's big and hanging on the wall. That might not be great.
My expectation would be like a full length standing mirror. But nothing says you can't have a mirror of life trapping that's a hand mirror. Aha, look at this.
Okay. You know, the DM can do that. I guess in my head, I tend to think of like you know, Wicked Witch mirror type, you know, size, you know, Disney, Disney magic mirror type size is
kind
of
transportable. It's still transportable. Right. Right. I could.
Yeah.
If I have my, I don't know, potion of gaseous form or something, or oil of etherealness or whatever it is, so I can slide into place, pop, here's the mirror, exit.
That's good. And you know, one thing I really like about this, so, you know, granted that the criminal can deal with that, one thing I really like about this is, what if your Assassin's Guild takes jobs, right, and for really top level things, say, yeah, we'll eliminate this, we'll get rid of the body, you'll never hear from them again, no problem. And then on the sly, on the secret, their mirror of life trapping them for a number of reasons. They have control of them, they can ask information out of them to continue their plots, and then they can also potentially blackmail the person who hired them, because they can bring back the person whenever they want.
I could bring it. Yeah, they could be back like that.
Right?
That's fantastic. Yeah, yeah. And then delightfully, you know, one of the other odd things about the mirror of life trapping, I had it in front of me and for a second there, I should have left it open. Maybe not odd, but one of the fun bits for that particular scenario, as I believe you can still use the mirror to still communicate, right? Anyone can talk with the creatures trapped in the mirror if they speak the same language. So, that whole like, prove it. Oh, I can prove it. Ask me anything they would know, and I'll, you know, relay the question. I'll give you the answer. Yeah. I'll even let you talk to them. I'll let you talk to them. Yeah. And now, it's a great for a kidnapping plot. There's another one, another way to like eliminate without killing that I had thought of. And Steve K has given a nice variation of it here. I'm going to put that up on screen. Medusa head in a bag. Let's say flesh to stone spell or various other means of turn them into a statue. I especially like this for a plot line of like, if you're very sneaky and clever, maybe if it's a popular figure, maybe you put it someplace obvious, right? Oh, we made a nice statue of so and so. Oh no, now they seem to have gone missing. You know, just make no note of the fact that the statue in the town square is in fact really them.
I can think of ways of foiling that, but boy, I enjoy that so much. Now I want to see that happen. Yeah. That's great. And you know what? Again, you know, it's interesting that there's nothing in D&D that specifically says you can lop off the head of a Medusa and then use it later to stone people. But that's the myth. So we should lean into that. And if I was a player playing in D&D, I don't think I'm the person who would go, that's not in the rules. You're not supposed to be able to do that. I'd be like, yes, this is exactly what's supposed to happen. Yeah. So for me, that feels very warm and fuzzy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And why not? Because it's not like there isn't other magic, right? I mean, there is, right?
Yeah.
There's the 6-level stone to flesh spell, which is traditionally reversible, right? So I could absolutely just cast a magic spell and you turn you into stone. And that always, for me, that always begs the question is, what happens if someone messes with that stone before they get returned? So again, for example, if I want to be really callous and disgusting, let's say I turn my enemy into stone. And then I chisel that down to just a bust, and I put that on a shelf somewhere. Great, here's their bust.
Right? I didn't think that's where you were going with that. Oh gosh,
isn't that brutal? Like, oh, they're technically not dead. Technically not dead.
It's really interesting that this seems, now that you've said it, this seems so obvious, and this never occurred to me in all the years I've been playing D&D. Why have I never thought about that? Yeah.
Yeah. I always wondered that about, like, once someone's petrified, what if the statue is then destroyed, right? Turned to rubble, to dust even, right? Ground it down into a paste, right? What happens then if I cast stone to flesh on them? Are they restored or are they horribly dead?
My first instinct is horribly dead.
Horribly dead is what I would think as well. Fascinating. But would they, again, so like, you know, okay, so I have an urn of dust of a petrified person that's been ground down. Are they dead now? I have not yet cast flesh.
See, this
stones
is,
of flesh.
Yeah.
Are they currently dead? Can I cast speak with dead on them? If I use other divinatory spells, will it tell me that they are dead? I'm not not clear. It's really not clear.
Yeah, I agree. That's one you're going to have to make that. You're going to have to make that decision. I feel like it probably, you know, it's probably not something that's handled classically in D&D because like a basilisk or a cockatrice or a Medusa, it's kind of half by accident that it happens, right? They eliminate. They probably someone's coming into there. They eliminate the foe. That's it. They've survived. They don't care about that. So you're not usually sending, you know, your basilisk is not going to be your assassin. So yeah. Turn to stone, ground down. Are they dead?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I think it's especially interesting when we get into the divinatory magic, right? Because that's what we talk a lot about, like, you know, never mind speak with dead, right? Like if I'm going to cast, I don't know, commune or some of those other like high level divinatory spells to find out what happened,
right?
Where can I find the corpse of, you know, who killed so-and-so? And then be like, well, they're not dead.
Right.
Like, are they, you know, I would hesitate on how to answer that question. Are they, or are they not dead?
I think my gut wants to say no. Could be wrong, but I feel like my gut wants to say no. Jeez, I don't know. That's a really good question. Awesome. Let me throw out some other. We've just with so many great suggestions coming in the chat. Let me throw some. I can get to the. My cue here. Great questions that have come up in the chat. We're talking about this now. Mark Clover, when we're thinking about how do you get rid of the body, suggested Sphere of Annihilation. Okay, so that's pretty. And I think that's canonically like it's totally destroyed. This is a good point, and I didn't think about that, Mark. So if you do need to get rid of the body, that's Sphere of Annihilation makes it entirely irrecoverable. Not the easiest thing for a thief assassin to carry around. It's definitely not carry aroundable generally. But maybe if you've got it back, I don't know, you get the body out in a crate or invisible. Joshua suggested the target actually themselves be charmed is one thing that he suggested, which makes sense. Use charm to your benefit, have charm person the target, have them walk out with you and then take them someplace where you can get rid of them, possibly where maybe you have a Sphere of Annihilation set up, possibly. That body's gone.
I feel like in classic detective work, though, you are now the last person seen alive with them. That's, you know, you don't need magic for to expect then that you're going to be you know, high on the list. Although I guess if they were like, no, they were buddies. They went out to dinner. Like it was no big deal. I don't know, maybe.
Yeah. This is good. Or charm them and then you turn invisible. You hit them with the first level charm spell. You put on a ring of invisibility and it just looks like they're walking out alone. Where
it just
they
looks
go?
Like they're walking around. That's delightful. That is delightful.
And I like this. I like William's suggestion of, and you could expand on this, frame a goblin for the crime, right? So lay down, blame monsters.
Yeah.
Blame monsters. That's easy, right? Yeah. This is, the whole game is about horrible monsters. Like, lay any kind of tiny little clue for goblin, vampire, demon, you know, what, dragon, minion, whatever. And the players... You know, your players will entirely swallow that. They'll never think. Right? They'll never think about that. That was a red herring.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's great. When you were talking about the bag of devouring, I was like, who needs a bag, right? I know where there's some trolls. Let's go bring them there, right? Like eaten by any kind of monster.
You know,
that's a pretty good way. Pretty good way to get rid of the body. I fed him. I fed him to a dragon, right? I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, my thinking was bag of devouring you can carry with you, right? You can carry with you, and it just looks like any other pocket basically.
Well, but again,
if you can get them out, feed them.
Yeah. When you were talking about the bag of holding to remove the body, right? Like, I mean, a lot of this is us kind of like, I feel like we're going down this road of like, how do you cleverly weaponize otherwise helpful magic, you know, or not helpful or cursed magic, right? There's, you know, I had a party who managed to trap a gelatinous cube in a bag of holding. So they had a bag of holding with a gelatinous cube in it. There you go. Bring your bag of holding with you to the victim's home. Empty it out on top of them. Done. Mm. Right? They'll dissolve. They're gone.
There you go.
And then, like, how do you clean it up? Don't. I guess, like, you know, when the investigators come, they'd be like, "Oh God, there's a gelatinous cube in this room. I guess it killed him." How did a gelatinous cube get in here? No idea.
That's pretty good. Yep. And you can expand it. Just find some way to dump a monster in there. Dump a monster in there and probably eat it. Yeah.
You know, this is a great way. You're out. Okay. If you're somewhat high level characters and you're out fighting monsters and you can kill two birds with one stone here, right? You're fighting a Medusa and you don't want to get turned to stone, but you have an enemy in town. Just teleport that Medusa to the enemy's house. Just pop. No more Medusa for me to fight, and hopefully my enemy is dead now.
I see that. Good. Now, potentially, right? Classically in D&D, teleport was not a perfect. Yeah. Well, actually, the main thing is you can't teleport other people. Traditionally, in most editions, and the only edition that you can is of course the one that you're used to playing, Paul, is the BX expert set lets you do that. No, I believe no other rule set lets you teleport other things without you.
Oh, that's super disappointing.
Actually,
that's disappointing.
Yeah.
Teleporting monsters into somebody, right? Because like worst case scenario, the teleportation kind of fails and the Medusa gets horribly killed, and you're like, well, okay, right. I killed the Medusa.
That's agreed with that. Agree with that. Yeah. So that, I'll say in BX, yes, right? In BX, that's clearly an option that's in the rule book. Other editions, not so much to my knowledge.
Okay. Let's talk about other weird. Here, okay, there's a great segue for me to get into other weird specific editions of the game. Because as I think I mentioned, I can't remember if I mentioned this in the last week's episode or maybe it was in the after chat, I ran a murder mystery game where we had a powerful NPC, a ruler, who was not dead, but was dying and was very rapidly, seemed to be aging, right? Was going to die of old age any day now because their aging had been massively accelerated. And the end result was that I had a clever assassin who was sneaking into the ruler's room at night and casting haste on them while they were in their sleep. Now, the side effect of haste aging you 10 years is, I think, maybe only a first edition AD&D-ism. Is that true? Am I right about that?
Yeah, probably so. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
And second.
But my Marvelous Magic book tells me there is a Cane of Age, which is a fascinating item. When it's touched, the creature must make a saving throw versus death ray with -4 or age 20 years. The fascinating thing is if you manage to save, you can now use it as a weapon. You can now, and it specifically calls this out. Okay, well, if you make your save, you are now holding the Cane of Age, and you can whack other people with it and age them.
Oh, wow. It's interesting. So, unusual twist.
Right? Right?
Yeah.
Can be held and used as a weapon. So, yeah. And that's, I feel like that's such a nice way to get around like the raised dead problem. Because if they die of old age, can you really raise them from the dead? Isn't that a... surely a limitation around that, right?
Depends on the edition, right? That's one of those gray zones. I think like in first edition, you can actually do that, but then they're only going to live another couple of weeks, I think is part of it. But I think, I think that's a place where the DM can definitely make a decision about that. I think for what it's worth, you know, right in the little brown books, original D&D, that power you're talking about of aging someone is given to the Staff of Withering. That's actually a core item. Is originally the Staff of Withering. The whole point was age them 10 years. What's the effect of that? What does that do to them? Completely unstated, of course. So that's exactly the kind of place where in original D&D, the DM has to decide, and they can totally decide that.
Well, and then this also bleeds into just do I have to kill my victim? Can I just make them irrelevant, right? Like, can I permanently enfeeble? Yeah. What's the duration on the enfeeble spell?
Oh, that, sir, is permanent. Of course.
Yeah, there you permanent. Go. And yeah. I'll just enfeeble.
It can be removed with remove curse.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah. That's good.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Actually, if you're particularly if your target is a wizard or something like that, enfeeblement is a pretty good option. Actually, a pretty good option. Are they going to have another high level wizard that's their colleague that's always around in order to undo that? Maybe not. Enfeeblement's actually a pretty good option.
Nice.
Yeah. Now I gotta point out the hard things, right? Now, Speak with Dead, which came up in first edition and allows you to speak, as we talked about last time, I think basically you have to get rid of the body.
Disagree. I think there's other ways around Speak with Dead.
Okay.
Which is simply to make the death either not possible or mysterious, right? So that even if you're speaking with them, they're like, I don't know.
You're right.
Didn't see the attacker. If the attacker's invisible and they sneak up behind me and they just tossed a, you know, cloak of death on my cloak of poison on my shoulders.
I'm glad you're bringing that up. Or just backstab, right? Or just, I mean, that's why it's backstabbing so that Speak with Dead, so they didn't see you when someone cast Speak with Dead on you. That's why backstab is a thing now.
Yep.
So I so declare.
Can I give you another weird one from my Marvelous Book of Magic? Because this one struck me as I was reading the description of this magic item, I was like, well, this is just a setup for a great murder mystery game, right? It is called the Death Rattle. This bone rattle has a black skull inscribed on one end. If shaken, all within 30 feet, including the user, must make a saving throw versus death ray or die. All undead are immune to the effect. The rattle disintegrates after 3 uses. So,
oh yes,
yeah, right,
right.
Disintegrating rattle, right?
Yeah,
you enter a room, bunch of bodies, a little pile of dust. That's it. Good luck.
Yeah, yeah.
What the hell happened?
Okay. Yeah. That's. Oh yeah, you're right. I agree. That's ideal. If that's in your game, your master assassin wants that. It doesn't affect them, right? It doesn't affect.
It affects the user. It does affect the user. It absolutely affects the user. Right.
Oh.
See, that's why you got to. Oh. Right now, I'm imagining something really gruesome and horrible. And content warning here, folks. You know where I'm going with this.
Yeah, I do.
Right, you just leave the rattle someplace where someone's going to pick it up, or specifically, you know, you leave it in the crib of a child.
Yep.
And,
yep.
Ooh boy.
Yep.
Dark. Ooh boy.
Dark. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. It gets dark.
That's sinister. Yeah,
but there's the save, right? So not guaranteed, right? A lot of those instant death things. You know, I was joking about the cloak of poison because, of course, that's like the most brutal, just like no save, you're dead, the end. And I don't know if anyone's is there rules around the cloak of poison that I can't like throw it at someone, like, you know, or just walk
unstated,
up to someone and throw it over their shoulder.
In an early edition, Paul, of course, it's unstated. DM has to make the call. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I will say, as long as we're in this couple minutes, Disparal had the reverse of the aging idea. Is if your target is very young, like maybe a prince that's, you know, currently the whole has a vizier leading them, is you could get in, hit them with a potion, with an elixir of youth, and reverse age them to the point where they are incapable or don't exist anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. That. Oh my gosh. What happens if you elixir of youth someone to the point of unbirth? Yeah.
DM's call, I think. I think there's a lot of stuff here that DM has to make the call. And I recommend that the DM come up with the most sinister thing they possibly can.
Yep. Yep. So there's a fair number of items in my Marvelous Magic book that do cause death, and usually there's a save, and then there's a lot of ones that are like weird where they just start getting a little strange about what is and is not allowed to bring them back, which feels a little chintzy. It feels a little in the area of Kafka's, you know, just hand wavy. Like, so there's a death mask, which is pretty cool. User's not affected with this one, but anyone, you know, within 30 feet must make a saving throw versus poison or become diseased. A diseased victim just starts to lose constitution points until they die, And according to this, if the Constitution is reduced to zero, death occurs and the victim cannot even be raised unless a wish is used.
Okay. Is that because the Constitution dropped them to zero?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, this, I was looking for something like this because in the earliest editions of D&D, it's clearly in first edition, it's very explicit. It's vaguely in original D&D if you read what it's saying properly. Raise Dead needs a saving throw to come back, even when you use Raise Dead, that's based on your constitution. And in original D&D, there's a rule, it's basically 10% per constitution point, more or less, at a certain range. So a critical thing, if you don't want them to come back, is can you find a way to reduce their constitution? If you can reduce their constitution to nothing, then there's actually a 0% chance that Raise Dead works on them. So if there is a magic item like that in your campaign or a monster, and I actually couldn't find anything initially this morning, bringing their constitution down before they die prevents Raise Dead. That's been a rule since, in the early edition, that was always a rule. For
So that's
if
nice.
If there's a poison that reduces constitution, you'd want to use that? Something like that? That's in there.
There's a throne of incineration in here, which will reduce your victim to ash. What is the ruling on Raise Dead versus how much of the body needs to be present?
You know, this is exactly one of those places where you'd have to dig into the edition. The original D&D doesn't say anything whatsoever at all. First edition clearly says that you need the body. And first edition seems like you clearly need the body, and then I think later editions get a little bit more explicit about that. And you know, just by comparison, I think if I was looking at Speak with Dead, it's third edition, and it's not until third edition that Speak with Dead says that the body needs to be intact enough to actually speak. And before that, they never say anything about that. So that's if you're working with an early edition, that's another place where the DM is going to have to make a sensible call about that. I will say that one thing I noticed is that in the first edition player's handbook, you can even successfully use Raise Dead on undead. My instinct would have been that turning somebody to undead would foil that, make them a white, make them a wraith, make them a vampire. But at least according to the first edition player's handbook, you can hit within a particular time span, you can hit one of those undead with a raised dead, and they actually get resurrected as a result.
Really interesting.
Yeah, right? It kind of surprised me. Maybe some other books say different, but that's what it says in the first edition player's handbook. So before we run out of time, I got to ask about commune. So in the first time that D&D ever came out, you have a cleric class, if you want to run that way, and at the top of their spell list, you have the Raise Dead that we've been grappling with, and you also have commune. And by symmetry, the wizards have contact higher plane, which kind of does the same thing. Commune is more guaranteed. There's no chance of failure. There's no chance of the cleric going insane. Later editions say they have to be yes or no spells, but original D&D doesn't even say that. It just says you ask three questions to your deity, and they have total knowledge, and they have total veracity. It's just you ask questions, you get answers. And so as a first edition, it has to be yes or no questions. How do you, as the best assassin in the D&D, as the master assassin, grandfather assassins of the Assassin's Guild in a D&D fantasy world, how do you deal with an opposing high priest just casting commune and saying who's responsible for the disappearance of Lord Goody Two Shoes?
Yeah, well, you know, a little bit, I think you still got to start playing your you know, I immediately land in the realm of like playing the evil genie role and start asking like, responsible? Is the person who paid for the assassination responsible? Is the grandmaster assassin responsible? Is the lackey, the person who actually, you know, did the deed responsible? What does that mean? But let's assume that it's something like, I don't know, the person who paid the money is responsible, and I want to be a really professional assassin and protect that person, right? Why did they hire me if I'm not going to like obscure who's responsible? Or even they're just going to say, oh, it's the Assassin's Guild, and like, I don't want that either. I want to throw that off of me. Yeah. How do I mean, gosh, that's hard, right? I mean, we're assuming that that's the gods hard. That you're speaking to are all seeing and all knowing, right? Like that they just
that explicitly says that that's black letter law, total veracity, total knowledge. That's what the spell says.
I don't know. I don't know if there is a way to avoid that, right?
Yeah, for the highest level spells, I get as DM, I get more and more encouraging of the DM being able to twist or modify that kind of stuff to make their campaign world, you know, make sense to them. So for that kind of thing, I would highly encourage DMs to change that, you know, if they need to. Don't change it just once for one particular murder mystery. That's the kind of thing I feel like you kind of want to think about a little bit in advance to have on the table so the players can't call foul on one thing. But yeah, Communing says veracity and knowledge should be, well, near total is what it says. And these spells do tend to say in the text, it says Communing is allowed but once a week maximum, referee's option as to making it less frequent. And in first edition, I think what the DM's guide says is at the referee's option, you could make it once a week, you could make it once a month, you could make it once an adventure. So maybe if you hang your hat on that, you say you can use commune, you can ask three questions, but only once per subject. Maybe just once. So if there's a murder mystery, you get to ask your three questions, and that's it. You can't follow up on that particular adventure topic anymore. So maybe you get some clues, maybe? Maybe one option of interpreting that?
Or I mean, again, it's such a weird scenario you're in now, right? So you've got to have access to the highest level cleric to cast this spell, right? And there's all these restrictions on how often it can happen, which means that the importance of the murder that we're solving must be quite high, right? You know, we're talking about like, oh, the king got murdered or abducted or whatever, something really, you know, super super high importance.
Yeah,
at which point, how, you know, maybe giving them that information is fine, because maybe it's not, you know, oh yeah, the Assassin's Guild or these political enemies in this other country are responsible.
Yeah.
Great. Like maybe that wasn't even in this particular adventure, maybe that's not even difficult information to come by. That's like, it's much more interesting about what are you going to do about it than figure out who did it.
Yeah. The other thing I was thinking about is, you know, usually like an Assassin's Guild is specific to like one city or geographic region. So it might be important, like maybe really key, to get an assassin from another city. Don't get one from your city. Get one from a different region. Get them out of there, right? And then they're not in range of certain detection abilities. They're not in range of locate object. And if Commune comes back and says, it was the Assassin's Guild, then you're like, well, which one? There's a lot of them.
Right. But I mean, this begs the question of like the wording of the question, who's responsible? Well, is it the person who paid? Yeah. In which case it doesn't matter, right? If it's not the person who paid, is it the person who actually did the deed? Well, then it's very easy for the Assassin's Guild to just have the right level of layers between them and the stooge who actually does the final killing, right? Yeah. Like, oh, you know, it was this random thug. Okay, but you know, you go and you interrogate that thug and he says, I don't know, this guy just paid me to go show this mirror to this dude. And then I didn't know he was going to disappear like that.
That's not bad. Yep. That's pretty good.
I dropped
actually.
The mirror off where I was told to drop it off in the end. That was the job.
Yep. First level charm, right? We'll force a person to do that. I had some weird compunction. I set up a mirror in their vanity. Right? Hit the maid with just like redecorate. I just redecorated a bit. That's all I know.
That is delightful. Yeah.
I will say this. Okay, so many of the most powerful, right, the most troubling, you know, magic powers in D&D we've been dealing with are things like speak with dead or raise dead or commune, and they are predominantly cleric powers. So how about this for a plot? Maybe if you're going to successfully carry out a murder plot in D&D, maybe your first job is eliminate all the clerics. Maybe that's the primary goal of your Assassin's Guild in your D&D world is, first of all, we need to figure out a way to eliminate all the clerics, and then we can do whatever we want.
Yeah, that's I guess that's an option. It seems a really, really roundabout way to come towards that one. And surely,
oh, I see it very clearly. That's what we've got to do.
We're surely going to just find other magic to replace this stuff. Okay. I'm not getting into this debate with you now. We have 2 minutes left, Dan. do you have any final thoughts on how to get away with murder in Dungeons & Dragons?
I think you got to think about it in advance. Don't just stumble into it. Don't just like sneak in the room and stab the guy a couple times. You've got to think about this in advance. So from both, right, the DM's perspective of actually writing a reasonable murder mystery or running an NPC that gets hired off the assassin's table, possibly, or a player running, you know, potentially an evil thief or something like that. You got to think in advance. A little bit about these special powers that are in the world and do something. So I think that today we had a really nice bunch of suggestions. There's others we didn't get to in the chat, so people should read that. A bunch of different ideas. There's not just one thing you can do, but do some kind of legwork to throw the investigators off or not be in there in the first place or consume the body to get rid of it. And the fact that we have a bunch of different ideas here will mean that your players will not know which one you've done. So pick one of these very devious plans that we've come up with today. Tune it to yourself, and I think your players will be find it a lot more challenging to try to track down the criminal than maybe the classic D&D adventures just kind of stumbled into.
Likewise, I would say, you know, if you're coming at this because you're trying to craft a fun mystery adventure for your players to solve, add a lot more layers. It can't just be as simple as the assassin snuck into the baron's room and killed him, right? We see that in Assassin's Knot. Add more layers to it, right? Like, expect that the players are going to come up with magical means to you know, I don't know, commune with the gods and ask, you know, who killed the baron, and have the gods come back and say he's not dead, and then
there you go.
Now the players are really confused. Where is he? Well, he's here just 100 years ago because he was sent back in time or something. I don't know. He's in another plane of existence. So, you know, find other more clever ways, right? Or who's responsible? Well, this person ultimately is responsible, but they hired, you know, group B, which hired group C, which hired group D, right? Make it so many layers deep that it's going to take the players a few different hops to figure it out and unravel the whole thing.
Also, I'll say, you know, if you're playing first edition or whatever, you're casting a spell that gives you yes or no answers, and you ask who killed Baron whatever, right, and they're not dead, what do you get back for your yes or no answer? does the deity of light go, null pointer?
Infinite recursion. Oh dear. Yeah.
Make that happen.
Viewers, if you have thoughts on clever ways to get away with murder in any edition of D&D, please leave it in the comments below. We want to hear from it. Maybe that will inspire a new discussion down the road. Or maybe you'll help out a fellow gamer who's trying to come up with a really clever murder mystery adventure to create. Please, we love to read your comments. Please leave us a comment here in the YouTube videos and tell us about how to get away with murder.
Yeah, definitely. Give us some more ideas. We need more ideas. And of course, Remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, GitHub, places like that. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites. So please find that like button and manipulate it.
If you prefer to listen to our show in podcast form, you can find audio-only podcasts on our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find those podcasts through your typical podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those sites and it offers the ability to do so, please rate and or review our show. That helps other users find us, and we really appreciate that.
Really do. And of course, big thanks to our patrons who support the show. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Every tier gets you access to our Discord server where we continue to have conversations all the time. Got ideas for this show from chat in the Discord and also the after chat. We'll be there in about 10 minutes, like Paul said, to continue this conversation. There were more ideas in the chat here than we got to. So if you had one, we'd like to see you in the after chat and remind us about something maybe we just missed. Got a bunch of interesting stuff coming up in the near future. Paul, remind me about what did we schedule recently?
Well, I mean, the most interestingly is that we are taking our show on the road. Wandering DMs will be live at Rising Phoenix Game Con. That is in Milford, Massachusetts. Get the date up here. Yeah, April 25th to 27th. Dan and I will both be there. We will be running a live dungeon design dash there, streaming our show. So that weekend, I think our show will be on Friday afternoon instead of Sunday morning or Sunday afternoon, as the case may be. We'll be doing a live dungeon design dash on Friday, and then we'll be running the adventure that we created at a couple of sessions at the con.
Yeah.
So. Check it out, risingphoenixgamecon.com. Again, in Milford, Massachusetts, April 25th to 27th. We'll be discussing that more in upcoming shows, I'm sure.
Yeah. I think so our design dash seminar is Friday at 3 p.m., I believe. And then if people are there and possibly looking for me, I tend to do like super late night stuff, to be clear. So I'm actually running a couple things around midnight and Friday, I guess 11 p.m. technically is when they start. So Friday night, I've got a live session of Wizards Warzone that I'm going to be running. And then I'm going to be doing a playtest, you know, just a day after we wrote it for the new dungeon design dash, Saturday at 11 p.m. is when it's going to start. So if you're a late night owl like me, please stay up and I'd love to see you there.
Yeah, I'll be running a couple of games myself. I'll be running some Fearful Ends. I'll be running the design dash game, I think, on Sunday afternoon. Come check it out. It's a great con, super fun, and come say hi, even if you can't get into our stuff. I'd love to bump into you and say hello.
We love the people there. We love the spirit behind RPG cons. So we recommend it, and we feel the warm fuzzies for everybody involved over there. And we're glad we get to get involved this year. So don't forget that we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So we'll be back next week, and we hope that you'll join us next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.